more specific topic within this area of fertilisation and embryo development, and that's particular work that I've been involved in really for most of my scientific career, which is looking at the way in which sperm activate eggs to develop into embryos, and in particular the way that calcium, and I'll explain what I mean by calcium, I mean calcium ions essentially, can act as a messenger within the cell to trigger development essentially. And somewhat we like to call it the spark of life, to give a sense of the fact that you need this spark to get the embryo development going in the first place. So, questions to be answered. Why study fertilisation and embryogenesis in the first place? Well, obviously there's the basic urge to understand, you know, what's going on around us, how life works, that kind of thing. So there are some fundamental problems of what you might call signalling problems, i.e. how chemical messengers within cells can trigger important events, and that's particularly true of fertilisation, embryogenesis. Still some unanswered questions about exactly how two cells can form one and then go to a multicellular organism. But there's also some more practical aspects of this. It's hoped that by understanding how sperm activate eggs and fertilisation in general, we might improve fertility, particularly a problem given that infertility affects 1 in 9 couples. So it's a huge problem around the world. But then there's the opposite side of things, which is that while there are some people who can't have children, even though they'd like to, there are people who don't want to don't want to have children. And so contraception is another area that is a potential practical side of all this. If you can find a way of blocking fertilisation, it can be an effective contraceptive. And also, by understanding what's happening during embryogenesis, then we might understand why it is that sometimes this goes wrong and we get birth defects. So, one question we've been looking at, as I said, for some time now, is the question of how the sperm activates the egg to develop into an embryo. And this is not known by as wide. I mean, many people are aware, for instance, that the sperm has a vital role, which is to supply the paternal half of our genes. But it's less widely known that the sperm has this other vital function, which is to activate the egg to develop into an embryo. This is a picture, by the way, of a mouse sperm about to penetrate the egg and activate the egg. Not really orange, though. And there's a problem faced in fertilisation, which is that the egg is essentially in a state of suspended animation. And one thing that's very important about egg activation, what the sperm does when it activates the egg, is to free the egg from this state of suspended animation. If you want to be fanciful about the whole thing, you might compare the egg to the Sleeping Beauty who had to be awoken by the prince's kiss. I have to be careful at this, actually. I wrote an article in The Guardian using this metaphor, and I realised afterwards, I was just trolling through the internet, that I'd been targeted by a philosopher in the United States saying that this was an example of sexism in science, that I'd used this kind of metaphor of the quiescent egg and the active sperm, and it kind of reflected the kind of sexist values, which may be true to an extent, actually, but I think we've got to be careful that metaphors don't necessarily have to can be useful without taking them too seriously. But anyway, that's one that I've used in the past, and it certainly gives a sense of the fact the egg is effectively in a state of sleep. And it's only when you get this activating stimulus from the sperm that you can break out of the sleep. Essentially, what it is that the egg is in a what's called a cell cycle arrest. Normally, cells can divide and divide and divide again. The egg's prevented from progressing through any kind of division stage. It's only when the egg is activated by the sperm that it can then start to divide and divide and become an embryo. Also, other things happen. Proteins are made in the egg, and eventually the genome, the embryonic genome, gets turned on. All these things stem from this initial stimulus triggered by the sperm. And one thing that interested me when I first got involved in this area of work was realising just how long people have been interested in this topic. So, I mean, interest in fertilisation obviously goes back to even to Aristotle and the ancient Greeks. Key discoveries. William Harvey came up with some quite important ideas about the importance of eggs and for fertilisation. is often seen mainly as a person interested in only in the circulation of blood, but he actually was the first person to realise the importance of eggs for all mammals, not just obviously a chicken. The chicken eggs are a very obvious thing, but he was the first to realise that actually mammals had eggs as well. Then following that, people like Leeuwenhoek, who discovered the sperm. So there'd been an interest over centuries in the process of fertilisation. But I was particularly interested to read about a character called Jack Loeb, who you could say is a forerunner of the particular work I'm doing, which is to look at the mechanism of egg activation. Because even back in the 1890s, Loeb was looking at this question. Even given the limited techniques and things available, those technologies available then, he came up with some really quite striking ideas about what was really going on. So this is a picture of Loeb and his colleagues in the 1890s. You can see the scientific dress has changed a little bit. We're a little bit more casual these days than these guys. But I think this was taken at the famous Woods Hole Laboratories in the United States, which was an important centre for studying cell biology and particular fertilisation. And Loeb actually became quite a celebrity in his time for his work. So this is the Chicago Sunday Tribune of sometime in the 1899. And it's saying science nears the secret of life. And this was all based on some experiments that Loeb did with sea urchin eggs. So what he did was he took a sea urchin eggs and then put it into different, particularly sea urchin eggs, and put them into different salt solutions. And he found that this would trigger embryo development without the need for a sperm. And this is a process called pathogenesis. There's actually in nature there are actually some animals that do this naturally. But this was the first example of natural, of artificial pathogenesis. And he, from this, then extrapolated to say, well, actually, embryo activation of the egg at fertilisation is really just a matter of chemistry. And that was a very radical thing to say at the time, because people at that time were still very much talking in terms of vital principles, some kind of magical force that drove the embryo to develop. And for someone to come along and say, well, actually, it's just a matter of chemical ions was quite a bold thing to say, really. And yet, you know, given what we now know, we can see that he was actually very close to the truth. So he said that one particular chemical ion must be involved, but he never actually managed to pin down what this was. But certainly at the time, it was a big kind of splash, as I said, across the newspapers. And so the idea that, you know, sensationalism in science, in the media about science, is a new thing. Obviously, it's not quite true, really. In fact, there was all sorts of repercussions of this. Jokes about ladies shouldn't really go sea bathing in case they kind of triggered some kind of pathogenic development, that kind of thing.
It's a horrible lack of biology.
Even religious interpretations. One religious paper noted that this basically backed up the virgin birth, because it showed that you could get fertilisation without the need, sorry, not fertilisation, development without the need for a sperm. And all sorts of speculation about the future. So this is a prediction at the time. It should soon be possible to raise domestic animals and children born without help of a male through an operation which would be regulated scientifically and almost commercially similar to raising the fry of trout. So there's kind of repercussions there of Brave New World, isn't there? But this was actually quite a bit before that. But certainly this idea that based on this simple sea urchin experiment, this would soon be kind of happening in humans was quite an interesting development at the time. Maybe people would like to discuss, you know, how sometimes these discoveries go in all sorts of different directions in kind of social discourse. But what I want to now turn to is, well, actually, what is the mechanism of egg activation? As I said, Loeb was incredibly prophetic when he said that this was essentially just a matter of chemistry and some kind of ionic change, because we now know that one particular ion, calcium, seems to be playing the central role at fertilisation. Now, this is maybe less of a surprise today, because we now also know that calcium, changes in the concentration of calcium ions within the cell, actually mediate so many different processes in the body. One of the first scientists who first started studying calcium as a messenger, as a chemical messenger, said calcium is everything. And in a sense, it's true, because everything from fertilisation through to every time we contract our muscles, hormones that are secreted in the brain, for instance, on neural signals in the brain, even turning genes on and off, and even the control of cell death, which is a very important part of how our bodies work, they've all got some kind of component involving calcium signals. And that's partly why my work at the moment is quite broad. It's not just about fertilisation. We're also studying how fat's formed in the body and how it functions, for instance. And it's because calcium plays this kind of general role. But in particular, calcium signals come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. It's a bit like thinking about different kind of frequencies on the radio. And there are different chemical messengers that turn the calcium signals on and off. Now, the problem we faced in trying to understand how calcium was involved at fertilisation was to discover exactly what was triggering the calcium signal. But before that, people had to then first demonstrate that there really was some kind of calcium signal in the first place. And actually, it was back in the 1970s when calcium was really identified as the critical factor for egg activation. So this is actually a video taken in 1977 of a fish egg. It's called a Madaka fish. And what's happening here is that the sperm is fertilising the egg here. You can't really see the egg as such, but what you are seeing here, and it's just a loop that's going around, is a wave of calcium crossing the egg from where the sperm fuses with the egg. And the way this was visualised, obviously you can't see calcium as such in the cell, the way this was visualised is that there's a protein called quarin that comes from a fluorescent jellyfish, and when this comes into contact with calcium, it fluoresces. So by injecting this aquarium into the egg, you can then visualise the calcium signal. It's like a forest fire crossing the egg. It's really quite dramatic. Now, this is an efficient...
Sorry, John, is that in real time?
Yes. Yeah. Now, things are slightly...
Can I just ask another question while you're at it? So, also, is that calcium that's been released in the cell into ionic form?
That's a very good question. That's something I should have made clearer. So basically, calcium signals can happen within a cell. When we say calcium signals, we mean an elevation, the concentration of calcium in the cell. That can happen because of calcium flooding into the cell through pores on the cell membrane. But in this particular case, it's coming from internal stores in the cell. So all cells, particularly eggs, have these stores of calcium, so it's membrane-bound vesicles, that contain calcium. When a signal, chemical messenger, attaches itself to a receptor on those stores, that releases calcium. When the calcium, the signal's then done its work, then the calcium's sucked back into the store, so it can be used again. So this is in a fish egg, but actually also in mammalian eggs, so human eggs, mouse eggs, you also see a similar thing going on. In this case, it's a fluorescent chemical dye that's been used, that's calcium sensitive, that's been used to visualise the calcium. And what's striking about mammals, including humans, is that rather than it being a single wave of calcium that crosses the egg, in this case it's a periodic series of calcium changes that we call calcium oscillations. And there's actually a big debate about how necessary it is to have these oscillations. You know, why is it that in mammals and including humans you need this periodic signal as compared to a fish egg where you only seem to need a single signal, and that's quite a big debate in itself, which I'll kind of come on to towards the end actually, because it's got implications for clinical medicine.
Do you want to explain the pictures on the right?
I will do that. So this is the actual egg being visualised and it's fluorescing, and then effectively what you're doing is measuring the fluorescence, and this is then recorded graphically. And this is just showing the different stages of so this is fertilisation itself. This is when a particular kind of aspect of egg activation, it's too complicated to get into really, but it's essentially what's called the polar body, which is when a part of the DNA of the egg is extruded, and then finally you get cell division take. That's the first cell division of the embryogenesis. So that was the kind of problem that we faced when we first became interested in trying to identify the true mechanism of egg activation. And when I first got involved in this whole area of work, there were two hypotheses for what was going on here. One was saying that some kind of interaction between the surface of the sperm and the surface of the egg triggered some kind of signaling pathway So that's basically where an enzyme is being activated that then generates a messenger that releases calcium from these internal stores. And that was the dominant hypothesis or theory when I first became interested in all this. And then there was another theory, which we put forward, which was that there's a soluble protein in the sperm, which is released into the egg. And by some unknown mechanism, it's this that then causes calcium release. And essentially, over some years, we were able to show that this second hypothesis, the second theory, is the correct one. But that still left the question of how, you know, what was the identity of this sperm factor, as we used to call it. And eventually, we managed to pin it down to a specific protein called phospholipase zeta, or PLC zeta, which is a known class of proteins that generate a chemical messenger called IP3. But in this case, it was a very unusual form of phospholipase C, or PLC as we call it for short, because it's only found in sperm. It's a sperm-specific protein. And when we were able to make an artificial form of this protein, we found that this will trigger the same calcium changes, calcium oscillations that you see at fertilisation itself. So my lab is particularly interested now in studying just how exactly this PLC zeta works, when it gets into the egg, how it's produced in the sperm, and all that kind of thing. But there's some of the questions that have arisen from all of this. One is that, you know, does calcium play a more general role? Sorry.
Well, why is the period short with your artificial one? It shortens quite rapidly.
It's a very good point, actually. Yeah, it's a very good point, and I'm not completely sure, actually, to be honest. Certainly, we do see differences in the...
And the baseline wanders up, which was the ordinary
one. Yeah, no, that's a great point. I mean, we do see variation even between individual fertilisations, but I'm not quite sure, actually, why there's a particular difference. I think if you analyse lots of different fertilisations and the artificial PLC zeta, you'll see generally a similarity there. So one of the questions then that's raised by all of this you know, study of calcium as a signal is whether calcium plays other roles inside the embryo rather than just at fertilisation. And a colleague of mine in Hong Kong called Andy Miller, who works on zebrafish as a way to study embryos, because zebrafish are very useful because you can manipulate them genetically. They're transparent, the embryos, and you can do all sorts of quite sophisticated imaging methods with them. But are you looking at things like calcium signals in this transparent embryo while the actual embryo is developing? And what he's found is actually there seems to be a whole series of different types of calcium signals. So you've got, say, a localized signal when the cell first starts to divide. You've got when the embryo goes through a very important process called where it forms the blastula, which is this kind of first when it becomes a ball of cells. There seem to be waves of proper calcium propagate across the whole embryo between cells. When it goes through a process called gastrulation, which is when the main kind of layers of the body are formed, then you see this wave that crosses the embryo. And then, fun enough, when you get to when the first organs start to form and the first real discrete parts of the embryo, you see these localised changes. Now, it's not really quite clear at this point what exactly all these changes are doing from a kind of functional point of view. In the moment, they look very much like pretty patterns, but we suspect that they're doing quite important things in turning on particular processes within the embryo. And that's effectively how calcium works. Calcium itself is just an ion, but there are proteins in the cell and in the body that they can sense changes in calcium, and then they will go and do things in the cell. And so, just to give you one example, I mean, at the moment, we've started to study the role of calcium signals in how muscle develops. And it seems that you need to have these localised changes in calcium in developing muscle for it to turn into a functioning muscle. So there's lots of interesting questions there for the future that we're now starting to get more interested in that are separate from just the role of fertilisation.
So the way the calcium wave propagates, can you just before you even go on to the next slide, just indicate if that corresponds to the various axes that we've got set up there? I mean, in gastrulation, for instance, is does the wave of calcium correspond to the, I don't know, the AP, VP axis or any of the others? I mean,
Well, certainly it's progressing in this case from dorsal to ventral. So that's so there is a correlation there with the axis of the embryo. What I'm less clear about, I'd have to reread some Randy Miller's work, is how much we can precisely say that's, you know, likely to be causing these events. I mean, certainly at the moment these are more like correlations in that the you see these interesting patterns that seem to change throughout embryogenesis, and it's thought from that they must be playing some kind of important role. The best way to really start to get to grips with this problem as a whole would be to try and find the different types of calcium signals and whether they're turned on by particular calcium chemical messengers, maybe knock out the genes that turn on those messengers and see how that affects particular processes. So for instance, we've just started to do this with a completely different protein that I'm not going to talk about today, which is a calcium channel in the cell. And we found that if you eliminate the action of that calcium channel, then you seem to knock out the muscle development. So clearly there are quite specific effects of some of these calcium signals, just from that base alone. But yeah, that's essentially that there's a real pattern to these things. And certainly with the localized changes that occur in during segmentation, they do seem to be linked to the actual formation of the segments of the embryo. So that's a kind of a wider question that people might want to think about, you know, the role of calcium and embryogenesis in general. We've got some more kind of practical issues that we've been looking at. One is that it seems that a failure of egg activation in humans seems responsible for a certain proportion of cases of human infertility. And I, as I already said, infertility is a tremendous problem in the world. In that it affects 1 in 9 couples worldwide, people who would like to have children but are unable to. It's interesting, some people don't see it as a problem. I've had arguments with people who say, well, that's just the way it is. If you're infertile, you should accept your lot. Why not adopt, you know, that kind of thing. And I think one thing that it can be very difficult to understand if you've not had this problem of infertility yourself is just how much some people really want to have their own biologically related children. And it's not so simple as saying, well, I'm sorry, it's your hard luck. You know, go and adopt and things, and it does matter a lot to many people actually to have their own biological related children. So personally, I'm all for trying to use science to find ways to help people reproduce if as long as it's done in a safe manner. And one of the things that excites me about the whole area of fertilisation research is that because of IVF, it's been possible for I think it's 5 million children have now been born through IVF, people who would normally have not been born to infertile couples. And by and large, IVF's been a very successful exercise. And now there are even techniques called, this one is where you inject the sperm into the egg through a glass needle. It's called an intracytoplasmic sperm injection, but we usually call it ICSI. And this is used clinically, quite routinely now in most IVF labs. But we thought it was quite interesting that although that in general gives rise to babies like this one shown here, in certain small proportion of cases, that doesn't seem to work. That even if you inject the sperm into the egg through a glass needle, it fails to activate the egg. One thing I would say about this technique, it's particularly useful for bypassing the sort of problems of infertility where, you know, like the sperm can't swim properly or it can't bind to the egg, can't fuse with the egg. But as I said, in certain cases it doesn't seem to be successful. And so we thought, well, this might be a good example of where egg activation is failing, because even though you inject the sperm into the egg, nothing happens, nothing activates. And in fact, we found that there seems to be a defect in Peel's zeta in many of the people. I missed the slide I was going to show about this anyway, but to essentially what we've found is that one particular patient we've been studying who's got this problem, his sperm, when they're injecting to his partner's egg, failed to activate the egg. And we discovered that he has a mutation in the Peel's zeta gene, which seems to be responsible for his infertility. So now, clinically, there are actually clinics that are using chemicals that can activate a calcium signal in the egg artificially to bypass this problem. So even this patient who's got this problem, he's now had a child. Quite successfully. But there is an issue here, which is that, you know, is it really good enough to simulate the calcium signal in this completely artificial way, and the repercussions for later development. And I think that's a big question that maybe people would like to raise in the discussion. You know, how safe is IVF? How much is it kind of really untested experiment? Because one thing you can say about IVF is that there's 5 million children born, yet the oldest, Louise Brown, is still, I think, only 33 years old. So there are some concerns about the long-term safety of IVF, and maybe we could discuss that. Particularly the fact that we now realise that subtle change in gene expression, in gene changes in the embryo, might have long-term consequences in terms of diseases like heart disease, diabetes, that kind of thing. But I'll leave that as a kind of question maybe we want to come back to. Another topic that always comes up when people have discovered some kind of new mechanism in fertilisation or is the question of whether we can use this to make a contraceptive. If you can identify a particular process in fertilisation and then find a way to block it, there's obviously possibilities there for contraception. And you might say, well, why do we need any new contraceptive? We've already got the pill, barimethazole, those kind of things. And it's essential because I guess that it would be nice if we could have more selective agents. Even the pill has, some side effects. There's also the question of, why is it that women in general shoulder the burden of chemical contraception? Why should men also be responsible for contraception? And certainly if you could identify an inhibitor, for instance, of our PLC zeta protein, that might be a very selective contraceptive that men could take. Of course, the question, would women trust men to actually take these contraceptives? That's an issue in itself. But certainly by understanding the molecular base of fertilisation, there's possibilities there for developing more selective contraceptives. Essentially, the hormonal contraceptives are very successful, but they do have these systemic effects in the body. The kind of dream of some people who work in contraceptive research is to make something that only affects the sperm and the egg interaction. And I think it was my last slide actually, was also to sort of go beyond this to talk about, to what extent is it valid to try and think of going way beyond what we consider as natural fertilisation. So obviously IVF itself is a very artificial process. It's something that wouldn't normally obviously happen in nature. But by studying embryogenesis, fertilisation embryogenesis, we also find that there are less barriers to what we might consider as impossible scenarios. So for instance, this was a mouse that was born from supposedly from two eggs, actually. What they did was they took a normal egg and then they engineered the DNA of another egg to be more like a sperm and put them together, and they managed to get this mouse that you could say is the first parthenogenetic mammal. Normally, parthenogenesis is impossible in mammals, which for reasons I can go into if people want to discuss it. But they were able to circumvent the normal processes of fertilisation. But there's a whole series of other developments going on in this area of research. People have been able to make artificial eggs and sperm, put these together to make baby mice. We have to be a little bit careful because when you might have seen in the newspapers tales of artificial eggs and sperm. Sometimes these cells don't even resemble eggs and sperm. They may express proteins specific to eggs and sperm, but they certainly don't look like eggs and sperm. But they have been able to use them to make offspring. And that's raised all sorts of issues about whether this would ever be used clinically for humans or not. So I thought I'd kind of end with that, really, which is that one of the joys of studying this area of research is the possibilities of trying to help people who are infertile or develop new contraceptives. But obviously it does raise a huge amount of ethical questions about where all this research is going. People also worry about the fact that, the idea of designer babies. I mean, these days it's becoming more and more possible to sequence individual genomes. I think there was a baby that was born a few months ago where they sequenced its whole genome, so that they got the DNA sequence of the whole genome in 50 hours. And so it's not implausible in the next few years you'd be able to do that for individual embryos. Does that mean that in the future we'll be able to read off the sequence of an embryo before it and then decide whether to select one embryo or not for implantation to mother? And obviously that raises all sorts of issues about that some people feel quite uncomfortable with. So I thought I'd end on those kind of more diffuse sort of questions, because to me they're being in ethics and the science and everything, which is quite fascinating.
Thank you very much. We'll take a few minutes break now, reconvene in about 5 minutes.
Not impossible, dear.
I suppose you can see
what's happening.
Yes.
the whole thing is where the whole thing is about what's added to mine.
When you go to a restaurant, you can see the